everybody. I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a podium hugger, so I just kind of got to get hands where they're supposed to go on here. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic. Home group is the Midtown group in Washington, D.C. Actually, we meet in the Bethesda now, Bethesda Roundhouse Theater, 7:30, right in the heart of Bethesda. Sobriety date's May 30th of 1997, and I'm glad to be here. And just kind of looking around, I did not get sober in the Washington, D.C. area. I got sober in Bowling Green, Ohio, when I was in college at Bowling Green State University. And so just looking around here, this essentially was my old home group. It was a Wednesday night speakers meeting, met at 7:30. It was the only speakers meeting in town. And the way the service ran there is there were like four or five home group members, and once a month you took on everything. You did the coffee, you opened the place, you set it up, and you got the speaker, and you cleaned it up, you took down the coffee, you locked the door. So once a month you had every service position there. And I remember when I, like a couple months sober, the first time I did it, I was going to have the best speaker. The best everything. Okay? I will say the coffee got done. I won't say it was the best, but the coffee got done. My speaker got confused about which week they were supposed to be there, so I had an emergency, had to grab somebody from the crowd, and I got to find out that people had a great meeting anyway. You know? And as I kind of go through my story, that's one thing that always creeps up on me, is a lot of pride. A lot of arrogance, you could say, in many different ways, and then it just kind of comes around and just knocks me to the ground. Let's go to first drink. It's always a good place to start. I started drinking about when I was 15 or so. No more than just what you do when you're in high school. You experiment with alcohol. I have not even met a normal drinker in the world who didn't experiment with alcohol sometime when they were in high school. And for me, it was the kids I grew up with in the neighborhood, you know, and just this Pleasant Valley Sunday, suburban Toledo neighborhood, you know, we knew the kids in the back of the neighborhood, you knew all your neighbors kind of thing. I think my parents, there were a couple families that, I'm the youngest of five kids, so they had their friends that had kids the same age as my oldest brother and sister, and then friends that had the kids the same age as my middle sister, my closest sister and me, and they are still friends to this day. When my wife and I had our engagement party at our house, it was really just a quick congratulations and then everybody getting together because, you know, they hadn't seen each other in a week. Like that kind of neighborhood where everybody knows each other. And so, man, it's a guy that I grew up with. We just decided we were going to get drunk. So, got a 12-pack of something on New Year's Eve and sat down to get drunk. There was no way around it. We weren't just sitting down to have a beer and socialize with each other on a wonderful New Year's. No, we were sitting down to get drunk. We were 15. That's what you do when you're 15. And we, you know, drinking for a while, got a mighty good buzz on, and got a call saying that they heard there was underage drinking in the house. Now, you're 15, you'll believe anything. We sprinted out across this frozen field in my backyard, you know, over to a place to dump everything. My buddy's puking along the way because, you know, he's running and drinking and all this. And we get back, and his sister's boyfriend is there with two cases of beer for us, laughing as hard as he can at us. So, first experience, a little scary, never stopped me. Never stopped me beyond that. And, you know, from there on, it was, you know, you drink when you can. You know, you had different connections in different places. You know, bottles of Mad Dog, they're flat. You can get them against a belt and get them out of the grocery store, things like that. And, you know, got caught once or twice. No huge deal. You know, grounded once or twice. Just learned that if you get caught drunk, don't come home. You know, find a way to stay somewhere else, or if you're going to get drunk that night, plan to stay somewhere else. It works out much better that way, because mom and dad aren't going to yell at you about a hangover because they think that you're learning your lesson that way. They are going to yell at you if you come home and puke on the carpet, so it's just easier not to come home. You know, the lessons we learn as we go along, and, you know, I set those rules for myself as I was drinking. That, you know, if this didn't happen, things were okay. If this didn't happen, things were okay. If this happened, didn't matter that much. Things were okay. You know, it's things changed along the way. So I was, you know, always a good athlete. I was a cross-country runner through high school. I was a good student, you know, all-city academic twice, you know, graduated with honors, all these different things at, you know, regular old Midwestern Catholic school. If you grew up in Toledo, Ohio, you were Catholic. Irish, German, or Polish. That was it. You were Catholic, Irish, German, or Polish. And that's basically how it was. So I grew up in the CYO. I grew up in the Catholic schools. And, you know, there was nothing much going on. I was came from a place where, in my family, I didn't know people didn't go to college. And so, you know, got out and went immediately to college. Went to the University of Dayton for 2.5 of the best years that I remember 50% of. And I will start with the ending. I was kicked out of that school as an honor student. So that's where drinking got me. When I got there, my sister was still a senior when I was a freshman. And it was really easy. All I had to do was walk into a house, because that's all it was. There was no bars. I made my decision for the university I was going to go to that was going to set up, you know, the rest of my life, as they continued to tell me when I was looking at colleges, based on the fact, well, if I go here, I'll probably have to get a fake ID. People get screwed up with fake IDs all the time, or I'll have to join a fraternity. I'm not sure if I'm really fraternity material. I'm by far one of the world's ultimate frat guys, even to this day, so I don't know where that thought came from. And then, you know, or this or that. And so I kind of looked at the University of Dayton where my sister was and said, okay, bar scene isn't huge, so fake IDs aren't going to be an issue. Campus is right here. There's a giant neighborhood where all the upperclassmen live, where they have keg parties every weekend. And all I have to do is walk in, act like I know somebody, and I can go straight to a tap and start drinking. Yeah, 4 years there sounds like one of the best decisions I could make in my life. And so I made my decision for college based on getting drunk easily. You know, I said they had a good business school. I don't know. It was okay, I guess. I don't have much to compare it to. But I made my decision based on drinking, and I headed there and got drunk, you know, with a gusto. But because of, like I said, the background I came from, I knew there were certain standards that had to be upheld. You know, I had my middle sister's kind of a classic middle sister, and, you know, had some issues of her own along the way. And I could kind of pick up that my parents encouraged her a little bit more, fought with her a little bit more about things. So I figured if I could keep these outside goals up here on a good scale, nobody would ask about what was going on back here. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, never look at the man behind the curtain. And so I got there and, you know, kept a Dean's List honor roll. You know, that's what it was, is that on Sunday when I woke up at noon or 2 o'clock, wherever I was, student starts. You know, get your puking out, get whatever you need to do, go start loading the caffeine in yourself, and hit the books. And you will be the world's best student from whenever you wake up on Sunday till happy hour on Thursday. Get everything done that you need to do there, and once that's done, turn it on. Doesn't matter what it is, you know, but make sure you get to that Friday class. If you can make it to your morning Friday class, you're doing better than 50% of the world that in your mind, you're doing better than 50% of the world, so go ahead and do that. And that's what I did. And for me, it worked. It worked just fine because I looked and said, I am having the best time of my life. I'm getting bombed out of my mind on a regular basis, and I am looking like I'm a good student. I'm working, you know, 20, 30 hours a week, carrying all these good grades, doing all this stuff. Everything is perfect. Nobody's questioning a thing that I'm doing. And got through that year of school great. The next, you know, in that summer, got a job working 40 hours a week, doing kind of construction and landscaping work for the county. you know, because I was hungover a couple times, had nearly lost an arm and nearly lost a leg that summer in work accidents, but you know what? It was just a couple days off. Wasn't that bad. Nothing too terrible. Didn't interfere with my drinking. That was the biggest thing. Didn't interfere with my drinking. You know, when you put a chainsaw into your leg and, you know, cut pretty deep, like 35 stitches deep, you know, they ask you what you were doing. You said, arm got tired. You know, a year or so later, a year or so into my sobriety, I kind of thought, I just had a long drive one day, and I kind of thought through that day a little bit and went, I think I was coming off a four-day bender. Yeah. I don't think anybody could hold a chainsaw in that kind of condition. And, you know, that's what I did. You know, there's a lot of things in my life that I've kind of rethought about a year or so later and went, nah, that wasn't the reason that happened at all. It was this thing over here. But that was fine. And I knew one thing from the end of that summer. I still have to answer to my parents even when I come home drunk. But they trust me more now, so I'm just not coming home anymore. And went back to school and set everything up so I didn't have to come home anymore. I'm just going to work all summer down at school, take a couple classes. It's going to help because I'll get an internship. That's what I'll do. And, you know, these were decisions about the rest of my life, whatever that was based on drinking. Everything. Drinking was calling the shots. There was no way around it. I can say that I wanted to do this, I wanted to do that, but if I really looked at it today, drinking was completely calling the shots for me in those cases. And in that year, I would say was, I think everybody kind of has, you know, their bottom. I will always say that everybody has the absolute high of their drinking. It's what they're shooting for on the way back down. When, you know, you were 50 feet tall and bulletproof every day and literally nothing could go wrong. And that was the sophomore year of college for me, 1995 and 96. I still look back on with great fondness of what went on. Because another thing I forgot to say here in the beginning is that I liked drinking. I liked what drinking did for me. Even today, if there was an ability somehow to spend my life completely bombed with no repercussions whatsoever, I'm one of, you know, the people in the rooms that would say, that doesn't sound like a terrible idea, because I still have trouble today dealing with the way that real life is. You know, it's much better, and it still moves along, but I still have trouble with those kind of things. And, you know, the desire to drink was lifted long ago, but still, I liked drinking. I still like drinking. And, yeah, I like when somebody comes in and I'm working with them and they're new and they're just feeling horrible and then just wondering about things and saying, well, I didn't feel bad about a lot of my drinking. I felt bad about the drinking at the end. I'll always remind them, until the day I took my last drink, I set out to have a great time. You know, there was no... I know for a lot of other people in their stories, there was a point where drinking was just keeping them alive. For me and my story, even on the last day that I was drinking, when I left my apartment that day, I was setting out to have a good time, you know, without question. And part of it, I would say I probably did. But the consequences and results that ended up coming afterwards are far, far, far greater than whatever mild pleasure those last couple nights of drinking gave me. So in that time, you know, things were going well. I'm a generally pretty reserved person with my feelings. I like to keep you at pretty much an arm's length. So for me, it was huge. Had the first, you know, fall-in-love girlfriend at that time. All these different things that can go on. And as all this was right up at the top, I mean, I was in a fraternity at that time in a position of some kind of authority there, had a wonderful girlfriend, was, you know, set up with a great living situation with some people that I really liked, had just gotten a great internship where I was going to be making, you know, more money than I had thought about when I was in college at that time, I piece by piece began to just slowly tear the structure out from under me. You know, at that time, I had tried to quit drinking because some people were bringing my drinking to my attention more and more often. And so, mainly out of arrogance and spite, I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to stop drinking. Screw you, I'm going to stop drinking. And it lasted somewhere between a week and 10 days. I can't really put a total finger on it. But it was, there's a part in the book, and I'm actually kind of mad I didn't bring the book. It says, you know, our resolve always lost out to some trivial excuse why we took the next drink. And at this time, the guy that I had shared a room with in this apartment was leaving school. That same night, my girlfriend, who was leaving school for that summer, we had a date planned for that night. We were going to be spending some time together before exams and then before a bunch of friends of ours graduated, the last time that we could really, you know, just be alone together. Okay? I called her about 5 minutes before she was supposed to come over and said, you know what? Matt is, you know, not going to be back to school next year. Now, I had known for a semester Matt wasn't going to be at school next year. And it seems like the guys are going out, you know, tonight for something. And it seems like the last night we're ever really going to hang out with Matt. Can we put off our little date thing? And would that be a big deal? She's a classic Al-Anon. I've since made amends with her and spoken with her about things. She's a classic Al-Anon. No. No, I guess that wouldn't be not a big deal. So I had to start a fight. And it was a great fight because it was my insanely trivial excuse to start drinking. Pardon me. She was a bitch. That's what it was. I'm going to go drink because she's a bitch. And, you know, continued on for a two-day bender on that one. And later we had many slamming down phone calls and yelling at each other through these 2 days of me being drunk and then eventually, you know, sobering up so I could gear up for an exam and then getting drunk again. And then we finally, you know, we're at a party and she said, you know what, all's forgiven, don't worry about it. So I had to start a fight again. That's what I do. Once you tell me everything's okay, I have to make it not okay again because I can't let myself off the hook. And, you know, it was probably, I've had some friends have some terrible breakups, but I put it in, like, amongst me and all my buddies, it's in my top 10. It's in my top 10 all time of, you know, just bad times when it comes to a breakup. And it was great fuel to stay drunk on. You know, for that summer that I stayed down at school, I tried to calculate it at one time, but I was taking a full class load, working about 40 hours a week, and managed to stay drunk about 75% of the time. And I still have no idea how I did it. You know, I have some friends that were highly functioning alcoholics as well, and we can talk about, you know, when we were drinking and the things that we were able to pull off and are just flabbergasted by the idea that somehow other people didn't step in and go, is something wrong with you? You know, for some of them did, but for me, it worked perfectly. And, you know, the main reason why, I had some supervision. I always had somebody to report to. I had a boss to report to. I had a professor to report to. One way or another, I always had somebody that could grade or rank me. And then that gave me an excuse to drink because I was mad or an excuse to drink because I was great. After that summer, drinking on the fuel of this breakup and all that, I entered the 40-hour-a-week work world in this internship that I was supposed to be in. I didn't have somebody there to rank me every day. I had, well, get your work done. So, Mr. High-Functioning Alcoholic turns into Maintenance Drinker. You know, I just looked forward to leaving at 4 so I could go home and drink. and, you know, took care of some other things. But otherwise, I was, you know, waking up to go to work, to a job that I hated, to people that I didn't want to see, to a place where I really had nothing to do, nurse a hangover through noon, choke down some food, try to get through those last 4 hours of the day, go home and get drunk. And that was the cycle for quite a while. And I just looked forward to weekends because then you could do real drinking. You know, you could go out and have some fun. You could go out to have a good time in one way or another. And one night, apparently the good time at our party was not a good time enough. And I was bouncing between three or four different parties. And there was a tradition at the campus that I was at that you would just see these large fires starting in alleys on random nights. And it was people lighting dumpsters on fire. And so I became a, I would say a dumpster pyro was what it was. If I just wasn't having enough fun, I went out to vandalize things. You know, if I was getting drunk enough, but I knew I was too drunk to try to, you know, meet a woman in one way or another, that I would just turn into a blubbering idiot, I'd just go out to destroy stuff. And so I would tear apart campus construction sites, steal things from campus construction sites, and set things on fire. It's just what I did, you know. Some people went home and, you know, tore out the windows and or broke windows and those things. I did break some windows. I destroyed some houses, too. But I just, I was a vandalizer and a pyro. And one night, I was setting a dumpster on fire drunk, and I got caught. Somebody was walking there. I had never, in 3 years of being at this college, seen a person walking a dog at midnight in my life. For some reason, somebody was walking a dog at midnight down this alley, saw me, and immediately called the campus police. And so I got caught trying to put the fire out. So, you know, they had an eyewitness. I had a fire extinguisher that didn't work because we had used it 2 weeks before to clear out our house because there were too many people in there for a party. If anybody ever plans on going back out drinking and you have to clear out a house, a fire extinguisher is a spectacular way to do it. You can't be in your own house for about 15 minutes afterwards, but it's just a great way to get people cleared out. And I got caught. And, you know, I saw what I thought was a great life in front of me fall apart. I was at a, you know, my life was going to be this college. I didn't have a plan for after 22 years old. I had the plan of I can get and stay drunk as much as I want here. I have connections for everything that I need. And all this is being ripped out from under me because they're going to kick me out of college. There is no way around it. They are going to kick me out of college. They gave me an appeal before a student and faculty board. And I knew I'd lose. But I only tell people this part of the story because it gives, I think, a good idea of the delusion that we live in alcoholism. My record on this campus for drinking offenses was about two every year up until this point. The average student on this campus had zero. I was running at about two a semester. And so I get up to defend myself, talking about my excellent record of campus service, going through all the organizations I'm involved in, going through all the campus different things that I've done, going through that honor student, that GPA thing, all the different achievements, and I sit down and I feel spectacular about this. Like, I know I'm going to lose, but that by far, if that didn't bring a tear, I don't know what would. You know, they're going to be kicking out a good man here. And we'll call him the prosecution over on the university side gets up and reads the eyewitness account and my disciplinary record, reads the, you know, sentence for the offense, you know, being kicked out of school for a year, and sits down. I knew I had lost at that second. All my glowing interpretation of myself had no bearing compared to the facts. And that's, you know, my delusion. I can have this great world over here, but if somebody brings me the facts, I have to go, yeah. Yeah, those are pretty strong facts. There's nothing I can really do about that. And they kicked me out. And I had a great plan of that I was just not going to go back to college. I was going to start waitering. I was going to start doing all these different things. And eventually I'd go back there because everything would be okay if I was back there. My parents, who were paying the bill at the time, had a different idea and said, no, apply to this college. And so I spent a semester living at my parents' place, going to school. And like I said, I'm youngest of five from a very good family. So I'm 21, 22 at this time, and living back with mom and dad, and still have to sit down to dinner at 6 o'clock at night. That's when dinner is. We eat dinner as a family, whether you want to talk to us or not. And my parents were in town last weekend to see my daughter and, you know, visit me and my wife, and we all kind of laughed about how generally uncomfortable those times were, because I'm a practicing alcoholic who is still living under the rule for myself that I don't drink in my parents' house or when I have a chance of getting caught. And so I am just have the spring inside my gut tightening from Sunday to Monday to 6 o'clock dinner on Tuesday and Wednesday. And now Thursday is out, because I got to make that morning class on Friday, and can't really explain why I'm going to go stay at somebody's place on Thursday night, because they'll know I'm getting drunk. And they've known I got kicked out of school because I was drunk and lit a dumpster on fire. Thursday tightens up even more, till Friday, 3 o'clock, pick up a 12-pack, head straight over to my buddy's place, and automatically everything's okay, you know. But it was just tense, uncomfortable, just horrid is the only words I can use for it, on both sides. They loved me to death, but I could tell they didn't want to be around me. And I could never say I really hated my parents, and I didn't want to be around them. And so we got 3 or 4 months of just waiting for me to find a way to leave, is basically what it came down to. And, you know, I got on my own again. And within a week of being on my own, back to maintenance drinking. Every night. Leave at 5. Get back whenever. Get through the day. Start drinking at 5 again. Same thing. I'm waitering at this time, so, you know, you have to be a little bit sober to be able to get through your tables. And then have a few. Take your drive back to campus. Finish at the bar that has no lights. The last bar I drank in, it was a home bar. Literally, last call, they didn't flip the lights on, because I don't believe they had any. Yeah, I went by the place sober and have looked in and still tried to figure out if there were bolts in there. And what they'd do at last call is they would just say, Paul, David, Katie, Melissa, got to get out of here. That was it. Because there was always 4 of us left at 2 in the morning, and they'd just tell us we had to leave. You know, sometimes they'd wait till 2:30. But they just wanted to go home and wanted to get us 4 drunks out of there. But that was my home bar. And I finished in a bar that had no lights. And so, you know, I'm broke and got a different job after this restaurant I was working at closed. The first paycheck I got from this different job, called up a bunch of people because I was going to have a good time that night. It was a Thursday night, and we were going to, you know, watch the Red Wings win a playoff game and start drinking. And I started a happy hour at 5, and most people started splitting off at about 7, 8, 9 o'clock. I went to a different bar, started drinking real heavy, you know, real drinking. I'm done with the social drinking, the fun thing over here, time for the real drinking, and went to meet up with the real drinking people at a different bar, hopped in my car, went back to the home bar, did a little drinking there, and I to this day don't know whether or not I was heading home or whether I was heading over to the other bar. But there are about 4 police cruisers in all of Bowling Green, Ohio, and one of them happened to be behind me as I locked up the brakes in the stoplight or stop sign, nearly hitting a mother and child as they flew through, and got DUI. Just got popped for a DUI like that. And it was the easiest job of grabbing somebody this guy ever had in his life. Because he pulled me over, and I could see the lights on behind me. Like I said, the loving family and, you know, all the different things with mom and dad, but there was one little thing that you just couldn't get by, which is whatever you do, don't drink and drive. You know, stay somewhere else, call us, all the different things. Whatever you do, don't drink and drive. You know, I grew up in an area where MAD was very big. It's actually started by a woman from Northwest Ohio. You know, my mom is a Catholic grade school teacher, so they have their positive addiction weeks and all these different things. And their biggest campaign was always, don't drink and drive. You know, always don't drink and drive, don't drink and drive, don't drink and drive. So here I am getting nailed for DUI. In their car. That's the fun part. In their car. So officer comes to the window, and I learned a long time ago that lying screws me. And I've watched many of my friends try to lie their way out of things, and it just ended up turning back around after a while, or they'd figure out you were lying, take you down the road for a little while, and you just get the crap beaten out of you for lying later on. So with any figure of authority, I'm just going to go straight to the truth. Now, I might spin the truth my direction, but I'm going to go straight with the truth. And so he came to the window and said, you've been drinking. I said, yeah, and probably too much. And was as gracious as I could be with the officer the whole time because I knew I was screwed. Everything in my guts had dropped out at that moment, and I was looking and saying, okay, let's just check the scorecard here. We have gotten, in the last 3 to 6 months, got kicked out of school, alienated almost all our friends, completely broke. I wouldn't say living to drink, but somewhere inside me I could say that's probably what it was. And you're just getting popped for a DUI in mom and dad's car. Yeah, scorecard's not working too well here, so how do we work our way around the situation? Quite easy, we kill ourselves. It's just simple, you know. You read that, and you go, see, work on a way to make all this better, die. No, I'm going to go with death. Just seems like a better option over here. And so I spent a couple hours at the police station waiting for the breathalyzer because they had to wake the guy up to come do it and all these different things. And even after I hadn't been drinking for a while, I blew about twice the legal limit. And officer took me home, and I'm sitting there going, okay, got to call mom and dad tomorrow because they've got to get their car out of the impound lot. And got to figure out the next things to do. Okay, what do I have here that I can kill myself with? Because it's well after 2 in the morning, so I don't have a car, and the drive-through beer place next to me is closed. I don't keep sleeping pills or anything like that around. Don't have a gun. Overpass is too far away to walk. I'm going through them all, okay? Don't like blood. Not sure if any of my knives are sharp enough to slit my wrists. Poison yourself. Easy. No problem. Start going through the laundry cabinet looking for anything with the skull and crossbones on it. I settled on liquid bleach. Nice. If anybody hasn't tried this before, don't recommend it. Took a nice big, you know, McDonald's large tumbler out, filled it about half full of liquid bleach, threw in a packet of Kool-Aid because I wanted to taste decent on the way down, and stirred well, chugged. I made it about down my hallway before I just started retching out everything I had eaten for the last week. And I don't know how long I was laying on my bathroom floor crying and puking, but something hit me that this whole death idea isn't going to work, so I got to go to the next plan. And the next plan was AA. I had an uncle who was about 13 years sober by that time and knew that AA was around. Also, when I was drinking, I could give you a picture-perfect rehab definition of alcoholism. I could have been a rehab counselor drunk. If you would have given me a chart and graph, I could have gone through the whole curve about this and then what happens when you drink and then the drink wants another drink and all these different things. And I explained that to people blacked out drunk, that that's what was actually going on with me. And they'd say then, why the hell are you continuing to drink? Because I want to. And that was it. And so I called AA, you know, for no other reason than to get out of trouble, but because I want to, it left me. I didn't want to anymore. I was just done. I was really, really, really tired. And so I called AA and asked where a meeting was. It was 3 a.m. You know, tell me where the meeting is Friday night. 3 a.m, you're desperate. You'd figure you might want to find a meeting in the morning. Nah, I had work to go to. I had to show up to work. I had to look good. Because you got to show up for work, don't you? That's what you do when you're not a drunk. And so they said, oh, there's a meeting here. It's just down the street from you. Do you want to talk to somebody for a little while as I am bawling into the phone? No. No, I don't. Not at all. Just going to go to bed. Bye. Play. And slept, I guess. Or I blacked out and stayed awake. I don't know. I just know I got up and went to work the next day and thought to myself, got to call Mom and Dad, tell them they got to get their car out of the impound lot. And I just called AA. They're going to be expecting me at this meeting. Even if I don't want to go, I have to at least be courteous. I called them the night before. They're going to expect that I'm there. And so, to get out of trouble and to be polite, I went to my first AA meeting. I've since found out that nobody knew that I had called AA. But I got to my first AA meeting, and the first guy I met there, I know him to this day. He's a great guy, Sam Smalley. He is my size. When I met him, he was 6'5" and mean. He didn't grow. He was really my size at that time. I was just really that scared. And I was standing outside the meeting smoking a cigarette. I had come up on my bike because I had no car. And he's like, ah, I guess I got time to burn another cigarette. And I was standing there smoking one. In my best casual way I could say, I said, it's a nasty habit, isn't it? And he said, yeah, I've had worse. Put his cigarette out, walked in, and I went, holy shit. Biker guy's going to kill me. Biker guy's going to kill me. And he was leading the meeting. And he looked around and saw that I was new and there was a bunch of other people there that he had known for a long time. And so he made the meeting on the first step. And he shared a little bit of his story. And because he had known the AA community that he was in for long enough, he called on people who had, you know, somewhere with a year to maybe 3 years of sobriety. So everything was very fresh, and I could relate to what they were talking about. And he wrote in a big book the whole time up there. I didn't know what he was writing or what he was writing in. And he gave me the big book afterwards, and he had written out where the steps were in different spots, some other things to look out for in the big book. And then told me that he was going to pick me up the next day. And I said, really? I didn't tell you where I lived. He said, well, I heard you overheard you talking about it over there, and I used to sponsor a guy named Spike that lived there. Jesus. Okay, biker guy's going to kill me. He's going to pick me up tomorrow, and he's going to kill me. And so, you know, he picked me up the next day after my parents had gotten the car out of the impound lot, and I had been taken to church. Immediately taken to church. It's a Catholic way of handling things. And, you know, and it was okay. And then after the meeting that he had led that night too, he said, this guy's going to pick you up tomorrow, 5:30 a.m. Now, I was aware there was a 5:30 a.m. I had to have been up at 5:30 at different times. I've gone to bed at 5:30. Why in the hell am I getting up at 5:30 for an AA meeting? And, you know, the guy was there. And I got taken to this pancake breakfast meeting with smoke so thick you could chew in a room full of bikers. And it was a great time, you know, good meeting. And I got taken to meetings and shown where meetings were over time. And there was a meeting every night in Bowling Green. And so the home group was kind of roaming because you saw the same people all the time. And people could keep you in check. And of the people that got sober in the same year that I did. One is still sober. Just one. Others have come in and out. Some stuck around later on, but just one. And it's a strong area with strong sponsorship and a lot of things going on. But you have to take that extra step of finding the book. And I had people introduce me to the book and let me know where things were in the big book. Since then, the big book has become a big, big part of my sobriety. So I was sober, but I hadn't changed. I was going to meetings. I was not drinking. I was hanging around with some different people. But the idea that if I could just look good doing this over here would be okay, then you wouldn't look at what I was doing over here was still going on in my life. So I was, you know, doing good again. Great job. Great grades. All the good things. Good in AA. Sounded witty in meetings. Chugging along. Eventually graduated from college and got a job in Washington, D.C. Actually, Fairfax. Where I was, top on the totem pole here, running a telemarketing center. Oh, yeah. Big stuff. And doing college fundraising work, which is what I really wanted to do when I got out of college, was college fundraising work. And it was great. And I ran that place with an iron fist. And I didn't go to meetings. And continued to run it with a tighter and harder iron fist. And I went to less meetings. And the fist got tighter and harder. And I was going to make that place a success. And I was going to make it work. And it was going to be great. And I was going nuts. And there was one guy that I worked with there who was a bit of a drunk, and we went out to a bar every night to go get dinner. So I was going to the bar to get a sandwich every night. And eventually we had one night where we decided we wanted to go out in D.C. And so we're hanging out in all these different bars, and I am losing my mind. Just completely crazy because I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do because I don't have that thing that makes me interesting. I don't have that thing that can break that mold for me, that thing that can make me want to go up and talk to you. Because most of the time, I don't mean to sound terrible here, I don't care how your day was. I'd rather think about me and just kind of be a loner. And it's the way that I'm built, you know. I mean, when my wife's here, she'll tell you, a stranger's just a friend she hasn't met yet. That's the opposite of me, and I do sales work. So I can do it when it's for work, but otherwise I'm just not there with it. And I didn't have drinking there to make that happen. And so I ended up somehow not getting drunk that night, despite everything. And said, okay, go into bars off the list. So I shut my life down to work at this point. And when I was hanging up flyers to get new callers at George Mason University, I saw a flyer for an AA meeting that they were having on campus. Something in me said, I'll give this one more shot. I'll go to their AA meeting. It might be a younger crowd. It might be some people that I can get to know in the city where I don't know anybody, and I'm afraid to ask to get to know anybody. Otherwise, I'm quitting my job. I'm going to find a way to go to graduate school. And it was unspoken. But what was going to happen is I was just going to go get drunk. Because that's what I was comfortable doing. Answering to teachers and getting drunk was what I was best at doing at that time. And so at this meeting, I met people who are currently in my home group. And before I left, they asked me what I was doing that night. And I didn't really have plans. And so I got taken over to dinner at somebody's place. I got taken somewhere that night for after the meeting. And I got to hang out. And within a couple weeks after being bombarded about whether or not I was going to get a sponsor or had a sponsor, because I still had a sponsor back home that I hadn't spoken with since I had left, that I sitting in a 10-step meeting and everybody was talking about their sponsors. And I talked to my sponsor about this, and I talked to my sponsor about that, and I talked to my sponsor about this. Now, if you are sitting there killing yourself whether or not you're going to get a sponsor, and you sit in a 10-step meeting where people are talking about their sponsors, it's basically a dagger in your heart every time somebody opens their mouth. And, I mean, I'm dying in that meeting just as bad as I'm dying at that bar wondering whether or not I'm going to drink. And I went up and asked a guy who is my sponsor to this day. He's the best man at my wedding, and he and I lived together for a couple of years before I got married. And the only reason that I spoke to him and asked him to sponsor me was that a week before I had ended up playing poker somewhere, and he was just really nice and didn't make me feel like an idiot because I didn't know what I was doing playing cards. Now, I am by nature somebody who can be a bit of a crap giver, you know, ribbing people a little too much, kind of making people feel bad about themselves so I can make myself feel better about myself. And the reason I asked this guy to sponsor me was that he made me feel better about myself at that moment. And since then, he and I, two different kind of personalities. He is a very quiet, very relaxed guy. I tend to be a little bit intense and in your face. He's very Eastern thought and meditation over here, and I'm a Catholic kid from the Midwest. You know, as many differences we have, what comes together is that we think the same. We feel the same. We have the same disease of alcoholism. You know, the same seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I did a fourth and fifth step with this man, and we got to know each other. And at the end of that fifth step, I finished, and I got to my greatest fear at the end of this, which was I looked at him and said, do I really have to go sit by an hour for an hour by myself? Because I don't do well sitting and thinking for an hour. So he said, you can take a book. Here's a big book, and here's another, you know, non-conference approved piece of literature, and take this. But at least try 15 minutes of just reviewing what we've done. And I did. And the biggest thing that hit me at the end of my fifth step, and I, you know, like I said, I'm somebody who can try to make you feel bad about yourself really quickly. I have destroyed more friendships with my mouth than most people and have opened, you know, with a kind word in their lives. I've, you know, had relationships broken off in a lot of different ways, doing a lot of different things. You know, like I said, I'm a vandalizer and pyro and all that kind of stuff. And the biggest thing that hit me as I was kind of sitting by myself after taking this fifth step was it was perfectly acceptable for me to be wrong. And in fact, I'm wrong quite often. And I'm going to have to get really used to that fact. Since then, I've read the big book through a couple more times, and actually with the guys I sponsor today, because of my schedule and my wife's schedule and us trying to get as many meetings as we can in, I do a weekly big book study with the guys that I sponsor, mainly so I can get an extra meeting in during the week. My daughter goes to bed at 7:30, they come over at 8. You know, a lot of them are saying, you know, this is great, this is the best thing in the week, we all get to see each other. And it's a completely self-centered motive. I just want to get another chance to go through that text with people that I love during the week. But one thing we saw when we went through there, and it gets pointed out every time we're doing it, is that if you look through the fourth step, and even you look through the tenth step, you can summarize that it says we looked for our part in something, but the actual words are our mistake. To somebody as arrogant as me to believe that many things in the world that I had nothing to do with can be my fault, the fact my mistake is in there is great for me. That language says for me that it's okay to be wrong. Because a mistake can be corrected. My part, that's just something I can just beat the crap out of myself on for a year or so. You know? And something I've had to remind a lot of people I sponsor about that as well. In sobriety here, I've had a great time. I've had some big struggles with different things. I am, you know, I am the only alcoholic in my family. And so there were little things that I had to do to be a part of my family. And it was mainly show up. I couldn't take the drink in me that was skipping out on family events because I was drinking into sobriety. I couldn't skip out on family events because I had to get to my meeting. Now I had to rearrange my life so that I could show up for my family and at the same time do what I needed to do in AA. I took some weekends that I could have done much better things with my time, I thought, and just went and spent a weekend with my sisters and their kids. I had zero interest in doing that drinking. They turned out to be some of the best weekends of my life, just doing that. And that was the immense. That's all they wanted from me, was to show up in their lives. Also, I met and married my wife in AA. You know, it's one of the most honest and loving relationships that I've ever had in my life with any other person in the world. And the reason why is that AA comes first for us. It was an agreement in principle when we, you know, when we got serious about each other. And it kind of came into an agreement in practice one night when we were, it was right after we got engaged. It was that night. And we had went and spent time with friends in AA afterwards, and we were driving back from Annapolis, Maryland, to our House of Falls Church. And we were talking about our future and all the great things that we wanted to do and just caught up in, like, just that state of absolute bliss that you can get in when you're looking forward to something great going on in your life. And her phone rang. It was one of the people she sponsored. And the only words that come out of my mouth was, "You have to take the call. Take the call. Don't worry about it. You know, we got the rest of our lives. You got to take the call. The call from the pigeon has to come first." And AA has continued to come first in our life. And like I was talking about the meeting I do with my guys, from having our daughter, it's become even more important that AA has to come first in our lives, not her life. A lot of the meetings that we go to have babysitting for kids. It was set up by the parents that went to those meetings. The babysitting room is offset from the meeting, so the parent can get a meeting in. As our daughter has grown up, we've learned things about her sleep schedule and the way that she's going to be and the way that she's going to act during certain times. She tends to sleep during the time when we would go to a meeting, even with babysitting. So we had to change our schedules. You know, I make it to about 4 to 5 meetings a week, and I was a big 7 meeting, 7 kind of guy. If not working 8, you know, that kind of thing. And I found out that, you know, my program is not dependent on me being, it is dependent on my butt being in a meeting. But at the same time, my spiritual life goes on. And I got the chance to live and grow through practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, I have a chance to do that at work. I have a chance to do that at home. I have a chance to do that a lot of places. And it's, you know, shown up bigger and bigger for me. And my wife and I have a lot of service commitments and a lot of things we do. And we have weird weeks. And, you know, got a minute here, and I'll tell you, in this last week, she had a service commitment on a Monday night. I got half a meeting. Tuesday, I had to do a treasurer's job for the local area intergroup. I'm the treasurer for the Washington area intergroup. And we were talking about there's, you know, visible service jobs, and invisible service jobs, and thankless service jobs. And the guy sponsor who had this job before me said, "Yeah, this is kind of an FU service job." So, you know, I have to show up and do that. And then, you know, the Wednesday's the night that she gets out with a bunch of girls and has this great meeting night. Thursday, she was celebrating her anniversary. Friday, we had to go out to something for my job. And last night, I was able to make it to a meeting. A year, 2 years ago, would have flipped my ever-loving lid. This year, just a little bit. It only kind of went halfway, you know? I'm not going to say it was great, but those kind of things show up because I have to keep in contact with the sponsor, keep in contact with friends, to let people know where I'm at. And it has to become an effort. It can't be that easy thing of just doing it at a meeting. You know, I really have to put some effort into it these days. and it's only made the program and what's in it that much sweeter for me. So with that, thanks for letting me share.